Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have David Rosenberg, Ira Harris, and Peter Buchvar. David is Chief Economist and Strategist at Gluskin Sheff. He has a focus on providing a top-down perspective to the firm's investment process and asset mix committee. Prior to joining Gluskin Sheff, David was Chief North American Economist at Merrill Lynch in New York for 7 years, during which he was consistently ranked Institutional Investor All-Star Analyst Rankings. Prior thereto, he was Chief Economist and Strategist for Merrill Lynch Canada, based out of Toronto. David is also the author of Breakfast with Dave and Espresso with Dave, publications of his economic and financial market insights. Ira's hedge fund manager and global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003. And Peter is chief investment officer for the Bleakley Financial Group and Advisory. He has a newsletter product called Book Report, BOOKREPORT.com, which has great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks, Rich.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Richard. We had a great pleasure to be here.
Great. Awesome. I thought we'd begin a look at the central bank policy. David, you recently feel that the Bank of Canada should pause on its interest rate hikes, but the Federal Reserve does not have to. Can you elaborate?
Well, firstly, I think that the U.S. Economy for the time being is already not just at full employment, but at 3.7% unemployment is already through full employment. And the Fed is below its own estimate of neutral. So I always felt comfortable with the view that in the United States, in a fully employed, stable price environment, you don't have a 2% Fed funds rate, you have a 3% Fed funds rate, and we'll see if the Fed ends up getting there this cycle. There's more skepticism on that view than there was just a few weeks ago. Look, the Bank of Canada, the level of capacity in the economy is far different. Canada is not nearly as late in the cycle as the U.S. is, point number one. The Bank of Canada never stimulated the economy in Canada by expanding its balance sheet. It never had a pregnant balance sheet to provide stimulus with, point number two. And we don't have fiscal stimulus in Canada. That may change with next year's budget, but that's a long ways off. But the reality is that when you look at capacity levels, unemployment, fiscal stimulus, there's far more reason for the Fed to be more hawkish than the Bank of Canada. And so that's been my premise here, that the bank does not have to follow in the same footsteps as the U.S. is on those bases.
Ira, do you feel likewise?
Well, David's point, I think, on Canada is really well taken. And it's been one of those things that when you have to look at if the Canadian economy could really muster some continued growth. I mean, it has been bad. But they won't have to overcome a balance sheet situation because, you know, I think they, well, first of all, they weren't in the same situation because of the banking laws and regulations in Canada and the dominance of the five and the way that they do business. So they didn't have that situation. But outside of that, yes, I agree. It's not that I disagree with David, but I think that's just a good point. And I've scratched my head for quite a while why the Canadian dollar hadn't been stronger through this period. Yes, I know that it's tied heavily, of course, to the oil or to the energy markets, or some people would say commodity markets. But in Canadian oil has borne a price of bearing a discount for quite a long time, first of all, because of the nature of a lot of it, the tar sands oil and others. But I agree. I agree with that summation very much.
If I could ask one thing that Ira just said, I mean, the Canadian benchmark oil price is down to $14. Now, we know that every benchmark's come down, but I would hazard to say that if WTI got down to $14, we'd be talking about a recession in the U.S. and the Fed easing policy. Well, that's what the Canadian benchmark is right now, is $14. And on top of that, household credit demand numbers in Canada have really slowed down markedly. I mean, maybe I'm old school, but normally when you have decelerating credit demands, interest rates aren't going up. They tend to go down. So, yeah, I think the Bank of Canada is offside if they continue to raise interest rates in this environment.
And your thoughts, Peter?
Well, I was going to add what David just said in the last point about the Bank of Canada having to manage high debt levels, a moderating housing market in certain markets, and, you know, creating some sort of, I don't want to say deleveraging, because it's really not deleveraging, it's more of a slower rate of credit growth type situation.
And let's move to a discussion on trade challenges. So given local and global trade challenges, what are the trends that you see on economic activity resulting? David, your thoughts?
Well, look, it's if you're an investor right now, not just an investor, but a business, I mean, you're fighting a war here. I guess Jamie Dimon called it a skirmish. She was being polite. But it's really multifaceted. You know, for one thing, we're all waiting with bated breath as to whether or not there'll be some sort of agreement at the G20 summit at the end of the month. And that's an on-again, off-again situation. But I was telling everybody that even if we manage to cobble together some sort of agreement with China, which I think is going to be very difficult when you think about what Xi Jinping actually put into the Constitution and what they can actually do to appease the U.S., how this ends up, I just say that I don't think there is going to be some big deal that causes a lot of euphoria. And then we're going to be left on January the 21st, where the tariffs on China are going to escalate dramatically from where they are right now. Remember, that's January the 1st. That's what's hanging in the balance. But let's even assume that we have a trade agreement with China that reduces the tensions. Then the next phase is the trade war with the EU. The next phase is trade war with Japan. And now all of a sudden we've got the House of Representatives, which are now controlled by the Democrats, who don't seem as a group too thrilled with the USMCA. There's no more room for negotiating a new North American trade deal because Donald Trump signed that with the outgoing Mexican government and will not be able to cobble together the same deal with the new Mexican government. And so we could see a situation where we're back, even if you assume that things with China go great, we're back to uncertainty over NAFTA, because if Trump doesn't get this deal through Congress, and I think that's actually doesn't get discussed, but that's going to make the front pages in the next couple of months. Then we're back to first principles with the president when he said during the campaign and after that his preference was actually just to walk away from NAFTA. So that's actually the dark cloud on the horizon that people aren't talking about right now, is that this North American deal is not a done deal at all.
Ira, your thoughts? Do you agree?
You know, there's so many moving parts here. I can't disagree with that. There are a great many moving parts. But the overhang to this entire market, of course, is the fact of the global supply chains. And we don't know what the effect is going to be about how much disruption is going to take place through all of this. So, I mean, there are just so many unknowns. And when they get to the G20, as David, you know, as long as we're going down that road, do they have to come away with some type of positive outcome? I would say yes. I think the especially the Trump administration is so attuned to the equity market. They've tied themselves to the mast of a positive equity market as being the barometer of their success. So they're going to have to figure out something. Like today with this equity markets under pressure all day, you know, you wait for Kudlow and Mnuchin to show up with some kind of statement. Oh, we're doing this, we're doing that. That's kind of getting old in the tooth. So they're really going to have to, unlike the last G20 meetings, I would probably say the last 5, 6, 7, 8 G20 meetings where they've really accomplished nothing except maybe talk about climate change. And I'm not minimizing that as it's nothing. We can disagree about the science, but the outcomes maybe we can't get away from. But they need something here. And China's, you know, Peter and I were going back and forth this morning because Peter wrote a really good piece this morning. And Pence's speech, you know, Pence These people all have short memories. Penn says, we don't load our friends up with debt. Oh, really? I've studied American economic history for quite a while, let alone American history. And we do load our friends up on debt. In fact, we used to collect it like the Brits did with gun boat diplomacy. So they better go back and redo their analysis. Of course we did. Whether one is state debt, the other is privately financed. But I'm old enough to remember Brady bonds and how those were worked out and how that debt was worked out. So they have a long road to hoe here, and they have to be careful because the Chinese have different memories about the colonial nature of the Western world, and that comes to play in this. So, I'm not disagreeing with David. I agree with him, and I think the outcome is going to be harder to get to.
Just a quick question on that. Ira, do you see challenges as being negative upon the U.S. agricultural commodities market?
Well, I think they've misplayed that already. You and I, Richard, and I know Peter, we've talked about that long ago. They couldn't have timed that worse for the agricultural sector, because when did they put those tariffs on? Right when the Brazilian crop was being harvested. The Brazilian, Argentinian, the South American crop was being harvested, and those, they were offering discounts because there was so much product, so much supply. So the Chinese could afford to play this game, and all it's done is just like it did in the 70s with the Russian wheat deal, you start losing markets. And that's the various thing. I think that's the farmers, more than the low prices in the short run, the farmers are really upset that the markets that they tried to build are really being diminished because of this tariff. And yes, I always laugh when you put on tariffs and then through the back door you start offering subsidies to the businesses that you're hurting. You have to scratch your head. It's a stupid policy. It was mistimed. They came out with guns blazing because they wanted to make a point, and the rural sectors of the United States economy held strong in supporting Trump. But you couldn't have timed that worse. I would have waited until now. But they were in a hurry because of the election cycle, and the election cycles are more important than anything else. So that's what they played to, and it was a terrible, terrible policy in that regard.
And Peter, your thoughts.
So I break down the goals of the administration into three lanes. One is economic ignorance, and that's their desire to lower the trade deficit with just nonsense. And then it's the technology threat by Chinese companies stealing. Well, there are ways of dealing with that. Right now, the U.S. government has essentially cut off a Chinese company that was accused of threatening technology from Micron. So not only is that company being cut off from doing business with American companies, but they're also getting tossed into some international courts. That's the way to handle the theft of technology. And then you have the third one of the forced joint ventures where you got to transfer technology. Well, no one is forcing an American company to do a joint venture in China. And then if they do, then hand over their technology. U.S. companies don't have to agree to that. They voluntarily do it. I'm not saying that that's the right thing for China to be doing, to forcing that transfer of technology, but no one's forcing American companies to do business in China. They obviously want to because of the growth, but it's not being forced. So my point is that throwing tariffs to address these three things is like throwing a football at a catcher at a baseball game. It just doesn't apply. The problem now is that you're literally freezing global economic activity. If you're the CEO or CFO of multinational business, you've clouded up all visibility. We're seeing trade numbers from China to Japan to Germany to the U.S. all slowing across the board. So what's happening is that the administration is taking for granted what was a decent economic start to the year and throwing it in the wind and hoping that it can somehow withstand these tariffs. The problem is, and I talk to and listen to a lot of conference calls, 10% tariff is not good and not fun, but companies can handle it. You go to 25% and all bets are off. And in terms of what Ira mentioned earlier about supply chains, well, many companies that do business in China aren't just going to pick up and go to Bangladesh or Vietnam. They're well entrenched there. They're happy doing business in China and sourcing product, and they're just going to have to eat this, or their customer is going to eat this. Because when you throw a tariff on somebody else, it's your own people that ends up paying for it.
Great insight. And I guess the big question now is, given these trade challenges and trends in economic activity, will there be a massive infrastructure fiscal stimulus? And if we can look at that question from the perspective of, will there be a massive infrastructure fiscal stimulus in Canada, in the U.S., and in China, where there has been a lot through the new Silk Route initiatives, and also in Europe. As you mentioned, Ira, the key to a European infrastructure program will be the issuance of a Eurobond, which will begin the process of unifying the European financial markets. Maybe we begin with Ira, your thoughts on that for the massive infrastructure stimulus. Will it happen, yes or no, in those jurisdictions?
Well, when I listened to President Macron, he would like to get there yesterday. And then when the Dutch finance minister came out today and said he was opposed to what Macron and Merkel had reached on a budget agreement. But that's really not the issue.
If we accept what George Soros and many others have pushed for, you know, probably including Martin Feldstein, I can probably go back to Ruby Bornbusch,
that if you're going to do this, you needed a real Eurobond, not individual sovereign bond.
You needed basically what Alexander Hamilton was able to craft in the United States. They've never done that because nobody ever wanted, including the French. The French never wanted to relinquish their sovereignty by surrendering their budget. It was enough of a surrender of sovereignty to give up their currency.
But to give up your fiscal policy, no, that was one step beyond. But now they've realized, if Soros and these others are right, you have to create a Eurobond. Now,
a good way if you wanted to demo with this, or, you know, is Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, chief of staff to the Obama, would say, well, you never let a crisis go wasted. Well, the Italians, I think, be much more flexible in their demand if they knew they were going to get a massive infrastructure spending financed by the capital level that presently exists in Europe.
And you could do that. You could do this. You could do this at the G20 and say, hey, we need infrastructure spending. Let's do 500, you know, it's just a number. But what difference does a number mean anyway? They've already bought $3.5 trillion of debt that Draghi, well, when there's no rules, you can't really violate any rules.
But he went a very long way to do, as he said, no taboos, whatever it takes
to sustain the euro.
Well, if you're on that path,
you may as well go this far. You know, why go halfway?
So I think the infrastructure for Europe fits easy, and you get that euro bond, and to make it all a bigger joke, is you have the ECB buy the debt anyway. So it'll go to the German court, it'll go to the European Court of Justice, but it would be a needed step that they need to undertake. Is it the best step? No, but they've already gone this deep, so why stop now, which is really the principle. And it will buy off, you'll get buy-in from the Italians, and you'll get some... You will get the optic of the Italians saying, okay, you know, we'll back off our budget so everybody becomes a winner. And you'll do it with German money. What better way is that?
David, your thoughts on the potential for massive infrastructure spending in Canada, U.S., China, and Europe?
Well, you know, I mean, I'll just give my thoughts quickly on Europe. I mean, the bottom line is that the only country that has the fiscal capacity to fund something like that would be Germany. And their infrastructure is top notch. It's like one of the best in the world. So I really don't know how that's going to be facilitated. I look to, you know, the U.S. and infrastructure after an election is just a classic motherhood 14-letter word for motherhood, infrastructure. We hear it all the time. And it gets people all excited. If I remember, we had an infrastructure package with Obama in 2010, and I don't remember that it spun the dial that much. People will talk about how the money never really got spent, although I continue to hear how things were shovel-ready. You know, you can use Canada as the poster child. I mean, there's no plan to boost infrastructure in Canada. There's other issues here that have to be addressed, but the Trudeau government, who got elected in 2015, the first thing they did, of course, was embark on motherhood, and infrastructure was part of their key campaign plank. Canada has already started to see that money flow into the economy, and yet at the same time, the Canadian economy is slowing down after never really doing a whole heck of a lot. I don't see that infrastructure was a very big antidote to what happened in the energy sector. And now residential investment is going to be going into a bear market because of its overcapacity. So I know that infrastructure makes for nice headlines. You know, if you're long municipal bonds in the United States, you really want to hear about how the federal government will fund infrastructure for the local governments. I'm not convinced that it's going to happen. And if it does happen, you have to remember the gestation period for infrastructure is in years. And this is no magic bullet. I'm not going to say that we can't use infrastructure to upgrade roads and highways. And I mean, I've been hearing about infrastructure for 30 years. We always need infrastructure, but as a tool to boost the economy, it's not very effective. As a tool to, say, upgrade the capital stock on a long-term basis, yeah, sure, I'm all for that. I'm not so sure, given the level of acrimony between the House Democrats and the administration, I'm not very hopeful we're going to get something done on that score. But even if we do, it's not changing my overall investment philosophy, which is extremely defensive at the moment.
And Peter, your thoughts?
Public infrastructure spending, it's tough to get more inefficient than that. And all you have to do is look at, I live in New Jersey, you have to look at this New York airports, the New Jersey transit system, the New York City subways. That's not for lack of money. That's for complete waste of existing money and existing resources. So to think that, okay, we're going to build some bridges and roads, well, that's being done all the time at the state level. So to see that we're going to throw some more money at it and think that's going to be somehow an efficient use of spend is complete nonsense. Then it gets to the point where, okay, let's just say we pass something, we allocate money to these different jurisdictions. Well, who's going to actually work on these roads? Where's the skilled labor that's going to be tightening bolts on a bridge? I'm not sure that they're plentiful right now. So I don't even know if something was passed that anything would actually get done. And there's a laundry list of wasteful spending projects that it has ended up costing billions and billions more than what was forecasted. And for what? So I would argue that the multiplier is less than one. And yes, over time, you want a train system that works and you want a bridge that doesn't collapse. I get that. But the multiplier is typically less than one when you're dealing with public infrastructure spending.
And Peter, moving on to your forecast, so what are your thoughts for the U.S. dollar and U.S. interest rates for the next 6 to 12 months?
Well, what the U.S. dollar faces is a Fed that's going to either blink and pause, which is a growing possibility at the December meeting. And I would argue that if they pause, they won't have either the guts or the data or the markets to end up hiking. Now, granted, they can hike every meeting next year because everyone's a live meeting. Now, I'm more worried about European bonds when the ECB is done. And I do think that we've entered a longer-term bear market in bonds generally, but that could take a while to play out. With the dollar, the challenge the dollar then faces is if the Fed blinks, the dollar is going to be in trouble. And interestingly, the dollar has had like two different phases this year. The first half of the year, it was very strong against emerging markets and traded actually relatively poorly against more developed currencies. Then the second half, or at least over the last couple of months, you've seen a rally in emerging market currencies, and you've seen dollar strength against the pound, the euro, more related to Italy. But I see these currency movements, and the strength in the dollar is not because something great is going on here, even though someone can say, okay, well, the, rates are going up and the economy is better here than elsewhere. But a lot of it is, I think, shot in the foot type behavior in overseas economies. But the second the Fed blinks, the dollar is going to be in trouble. And, you know, that could be the end of the dollar rally, because the U.S. government's still facing massive debts and deficits, which over time is going to be very dollar negative. And just as the years go on, there's going to be less dollar transactions taking place. Now, that's a very long-term story. I know it gets a lot of press now, but I see a lot of secular headwinds for the U.S. dollar, notwithstanding, you know, current bits of strength against certain currencies.
And David, your forecast for the U.S. dollar and U.S. interest rates for the next 6 to 12 months?
Well, I think that, well, firstly, on the U.S. dollar, you know, it's been very tempting to be bullish on the U.S. dollar because the Fed, you know, textbook economics, easy fiscal policy, tight monetary policy will always and everywhere give you a bull market in your currency. But I think that story has largely played its course. I'm getting a little nervous over the bull market in the U.S. dollar, and I'll tell you why. Firstly, the chart today looks absolutely ugly of the DXY, but I'm looking at the latest commitment in the traders report, and I'm looking that on the Intercontinental Exchange, the trade-weighted U.S. dollar has a net speculative long position over 40,000 contracts. We haven't seen this in about a year and a half. So there's a lot of just a huge overhang of speculative naked longs right now that could easily exit this overcrowded trade and set the conditions for a pretty big reversal in the U.S. dollar going down as opposed to up. I agree with Peter that, you know, the most important determinant really of a currency is relative interest rate differentials. And one of the reasons why the U.S. dollar is succumbing right now isn't just that these naked longs are starting to exit the market, but the reason why, and that's because the Fed, in a matter of about 6 weeks, has gone from hawkish to, well, I wouldn't say they're dovish, but certainly less hawkish enough that you've had already, just in a matter of weeks, a full rate hike priced in for next year come out of the marketplace. You know, we were supposedly, according to Jay Powell, October the 3rd, a long way from neutral. We may have to go beyond neutral. And now everybody's talking about, no, neutral is enough. And by the way, maybe we're one or two rate hikes away. So that's undercutting the U.S. dollar at the current time. The outlook for interest rates, you know, a lot can happen in a year. You know, it's I'm probably at this stage maybe less bearish on treasuries than Peter is. You know, I think we may look back and say that, you know, that when we approached you know, when we got to 3.25% of the 10-year, you know, maybe that was the peak. And I think that there's a lot of cross currents. You have the cost push inflation forces from extremely tight labor market and from these tariffs. But at the same time, that's battling the cyclicality of a decelerating global economy and U.S. economy. So I think that we should just take our cue, you know, from the market itself. You know, here we've taken out a full rate cut for next year. Here we've got a lot of slowing growth, another turn down in the stock market, and the best we can do was 3.05 on the 10-year note. I mean, the 10-year note in this, you know, this mix of widening credit spreads, a deteriorating stock market, less bearish view or hawkish view on the Fed, and this, the best you get is 20 basis points off the 10-year note. I mean, normally in the past, when you had this sort of condition, especially in the stock market, the 10-year note yield was down 80 basis points, not 20. So the market's telling us something here, and maybe it's over and beyond just talking about tariffs and the cost push inflation, wages, the cost push inflation, but the fact that we're really choking on supply. I mean, Peter Buchfarb comments all the time on what's happening with these treasury auctions, and the reality is that this time last year, the deficit was supposed to be $600 billion this year. Well, it's going to be north of $1 trillion. So we were choking on treasury supply that we weren't supposed to get, except the bright lights in Congress and the White House thought that cutting taxes at a time of full employment was a really great idea. But it's Newton's third law of motion. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. The opposite reaction is that bond yields are not falling when they should be falling. And that ends up being another problem for the stock market, because stock markets put in their lows. When you get to a certain relationship between the bond yield and the earnings yield in the stock market, the problem for the stock market, and maybe for those people uber long treasuries, is that you're not getting a normal response here. The reason is because there's just too much supply. The street's left with too much product after these auctions, and the street has to, then the dealers have to dump this product, and it's putting an underlying floor under bond yields right now. To me, that's the big story. So I think we're probably just stuck in a range for the foreseeable future as far as the treasury market's concerned.
And Ira, your views?
Well, I'm going to be very simpatico with this, but let me pick up where Peter Buchbar was just talking about on CNBC, which is, of course, the huge amount of corporate investment debt to throw onto this, and how much of it is actually LIBOR-based, which makes it even more telling. So, yes, it, you know, as we've talked about, Richard and Peter and with David a little bit, you know, debt is to financial markets what location is to real estate. That's the way that I view it, and I hold true to that. And I think that David's warnings are very, very important. And Peter's been there too, because we turned bearish the dollar, I think, at the same time in that February of 2017 when we saw the move come, Peter and I. So this movement in the dollar is going up very grudgingly. And I, like David, am old enough to know that when you have these interest rate differentials, and with negative nominal, forget real, but nominal rates being negative in certain parts of the world, and yet those currencies are not really weakening as they ought to. And coupled that with David's comments about why aren't these bonds a lot higher, that poses the question that the United States is really drowning in debt, and the world sees it. And you, it's like you hold your nose when you buy dollar assets today, because, you know, there's very little else to buy, but you buy it cautiously. And I think that, you know, some of it is right because it's too expensive right now to hedge it away. So a lot of people buy it and go, well, if I pay for the hedge, I'm basically breaking even. So what's the sense of doing that? So I think some people stay away from it. But David's point is absolutely well taken. I'm watching these curves. Right now, the 530 curve, which I call the speculative curve, is getting interesting because it's moved while the 210 has kind of stayed stagnant. But I would say that's because people have more duration matches that they have to put on. But as I tell people, if you buy a U.S. A U.S. bond of longer than 5-year duration, you need your head examined and ought to go looking for another profession, because you're an idiot. You're an idiot unless you have duration that you have to cover, because it makes zero sense. Because as David talks about, this budget is this deficit this year is over $1 trillion. And this is, I'm not an anti-Trump. I'm from the school of Deng Xiaoping. I don't care whether the cat is black or white, as long as it catches mice. This is a president who's never met a debt he doesn't want to take on. So if he really gets into trouble, and that's been my point, and that's why, you know, I agree about the structural basis of infrastructure spending, but this is somebody who's looking to spend. And if he finds, you know, simpatico voices from the Democratic Party in the House, he will get his way, because he's already said he doesn't care about debt. And you know what? The Freedom Caucus, who was the voice of fiscal austerity and soundness and responsibility, they're on their heels right now. So I would not be buying a piece of U.S. paper over 5 years. That's I think you're out of your mind. And the equity markets, as David points out, is telling you that, because as we look at this board, okay, what's the 10-year at though? Right now I got it in front of me. What, 3.05? Really? That's all you got after a 15%, you know, drop from the high to the recent low in the equity markets? That's all you've so to me it's a warning sign.
In the month of October, the stock market and the bond market went down. Yields rose across the curve in October when equities fell as much as they did.
And finally, let's look at what investors can do to for investing or protecting themselves going into 2019. David, you've referenced four letters, QLDS, quality, liquidity, defensiveness, and selectiveness. Can you elaborate?
Well, sure. I think that, you know, when you're talking about this, and a step up in quality, both across the capital structure, so you know, equities and debt. And if your mandate is equities, I think you have to be very mindful of the degree of cyclicality that you have in your portfolio, and focus on earnings visibility, and limit as much as you can your overall GDP sensitivity. And I think classically late cycle, I think we're in the top of the ninth. I think when you get to the top of the ninth, historically is the rare period where value outperforms growth. And I think that will continue to be a theme, maybe a theme that works more in relative terms than absolute terms, but it will work in relative terms. And I think, as Ira had said, and Peter would agree, that being very mindful of your duration in the fixed income portfolio is very important, really until you see the white to the eyes of the recession, which I think at some point will come next year. But, you know, recession is like an odorless gas. You know, everybody likes to say that, I don't see a recession coming. Well, most people don't see a recession coming when it's already hit. But you want to be mindful of that up until a certain point when things really start to turn around. You're going to start extending duration, keeping in mind that inflation is going to be a problem, but is at the same time a bit of a lagging indicator, as we saw in 2008. That's the quality part. Liquidity, I think, is pretty obvious. You want to have cash on hand for optionality, or maybe more than that, to put to work at the beginning of the next cycle, now that we're transitioning out of this long bull market. So you want to use cash. And look, at this time last year, cash paid you 1%. Today, cash, looking at just where four-week treasury bills are trading, you're getting well over 2%. You're getting better than you get in the dividend yield in the stock market. So you get paid to be in cash today. And I think that was a very prudent thing to do. You want to end up being, when all said and done, a lender in this market, not a borrower. LQDS, D for defensiveness, that goes back into quality, basically, perhaps a subset. But again, be mindful, the OECD leading indicator is down 10 months in a row. So you haven't seen anything yet. This is the thin edge of the wedge. The global economy is going to be weakening even more next year than it has from the previous year. So that means you have to be defensive. And of course, I would go back to the fixed income market, especially in corporates, when you consider that next year is the first of the next four years where you're going to have a tsunami of debt refinancings in the corporate sector at a time where 50% of the investment grade universe is rated triple B. There's going to be lots of volatility. Defensive also means very mindful in your fixed income portfolio and credit as to what the maturity schedule of the debt looks like in the companies that you own. Selectivity just means style investing, no different than late cycle value over growth. Late cycle means you want to own as few stocks and few securities as possible. You want to cull the portfolio. Okay, if early in the cycle you own 60 stocks and mid-cycle you own 40 stocks, you want to have 20 late cycle. You want to get down to your most blue chip, liquid, relatively safe names. The selectivity really means to really just have a best idea portfolio and nothing else.
And Peter, your thoughts?
Yeah, to add to that, so looking at if you're going to be in equities, at least for many listening, possibly U.S. or Canadian equities, boring is good. Boring businesses, cheap valuations, not exciting, that's what people should focus on. And I think in this downturn overseas, particularly Asian emerging markets, and that includes China, I think there's a lot of value being created. I mean, the Chinese stock market has been, as inefficient as it is, has been through a bear market. It's down 60%. Well, now probably about 50 from its 07 peak, let alone where it's off from the 2015 high. And to add, again, short duration, I'd be in gold and silver as part of my weak dollar belief next year when the Fed blinks. I think gold and silver are going to be up a lot when that happens. And I think it's as simple as that. And having cash. And there are times to play offense, but times to play defense. This is one of those times to play defense. There's times to own gold and silver. There are times not to own it. Now is one of the times to own it. So boring is good. And I would stick to that.
And finally, Ira.
There's so much that I agree with there. You know, at the metals, I think they'll have their day. People have been a little bit unnerved because of the rising interest rates in the United States. But, you know, it's more than just rising interest rates, because we see 8% in Mexico. And I would argue that Mexico is probably a far better investment right now than a lot of other places. Yes, I know that AMLO is coming on, and there are some uncertainties, of course, that exist there. But the United States has its own inconsistencies. You know, part of it is, you know, who's running the show. And, you know, I don't think we've had a high-quality Secretary of Treasury probably since the, and we could argue about that, the Reuben Summer years. There was nobody, I was not a Hank Paulson fan. I was certainly not a Jack Lew fan. I was certainly not a Tim Geithner fan. And I am less a Mnuchin fan. And yet all of this is taking place. So when I buy a country's sovereign bonds, you know, I'm buying not only what their the balance sheet looks like and their financial state, but I'm also buying the credibility of the people in charge. So again, you got to be very careful here. I think that David and Peter are both making really great points about where yields have gotten to in the face of all this, and the inability of the dollar to really have a sizable rally. Because David hits it right on the head. You know, I traded my way through Volcker and Reagan. So we had the classic case of fiscal stimulus with tight monetary policy, and the dollar boomed. It boomed so the dollar strengthened so much that, of course, they had to undo it through the Plaza Accord. We've gotten nothing out of this. Really, when you look at it, if you put up a long-term chart over the last years, okay. You know, I could say the euro was born at 117.85 in January 1st, 1999. We're not that far. We're at 114.50, and Europe is saddled with nothing but problems, and still the dollar doesn't rally. Now, that doesn't mean today it can't rally, tomorrow it can't rally, next week. But when you look at its overall performance, I would be very leery. There are movements afoot here. There are things underneath the surface that are bubbling that you have to be attentive to. And it's what ought to be happening that isn't happening. And that should be a warning sign to everybody.
Great insight, gentlemen. How can our listeners learn more about your work, David?
Well, you could either call me directly at 416-681-8919 or email me at drosenberg@gluskinchef.com. And I'd be happy to get anybody on a trial for my two morning publications, Espresso with Dave and Breakfast with Dave. Best ways to reach me, once again, either phone or email.
Great. And Peter?
You can reach me at peter.bookvar@bleakleyadvisory.com. And I have a C after the two double O's and after the double O's my last name. For wealth management advice or macro market advice, where you can go to the website, bookreport.com, B-O-O-C-K, report.com.
Great. And Ira?
Yeah, just notes from underground, or you can go to iraharris.com and register for it there. And if you write to notes from underground and it's not low quality trolling, but high quality, you'll get an answer, because there are a lot of people who will respond to you. It's a nice give and take on the blog. So, again, it's not a tout sheet. We don't tout. We try to create ideas and let you'll do the work. We'll just try to point you in a direction to see if it has any possible investment rewards. So it's a great place for two-way communication and for dialogue, which so much of this business is about dialoguing with people who you respect. And nothing does it better than this podcast that we're sitting on right now. So,
great. Thank you very much, and we'll end it there. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.